This is where we live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Do you think curbing emissions from the cars we drive or coal power plants is a cure-all for addressing climate change? Think again. Actually, the food we consume plays a big part. Today, where we live, we explore the impact our diets have on the planet. A study published in the journal Science finds that beef cattle raised on deforested land result in 12 times more greenhouse gases and use 50 times more land than those grazing rich natural pasture. Coming up, we're going to talk to a beef farmer in Connecticut about alternative ways to raise livestock. At least 80% of beef eaten in the U.S. is domestic. And the USDA says this year alone, the average American consumer will eat 222 pounds of red meat and poultry. Is switching to a plant-based diet realistic? Certainly that's not an option in some countries where getting enough food to hungry people is a more pressing issue. But we want to hear from you this hour. Have you thought about changing what you eat to lessen your carbon footprint? You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. You can email us, wherewelive at WMPR.org. And as always, find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Now, for more on the impact livestock has around the globe, joining us from Rome is Anne Moté. She's a livestock expert at the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO. And welcome to our show.
Thank you. Good morning.
So we were talking about livestock agriculture making up a big chunk of our carbon output worldwide. But can you talk about exactly how much global greenhouse gas emissions come from livestock?
Yes, so we can start by looking at the emissions from livestock in two types. You have the what we call the direct emissions and the indirect ones. Direct emissions are the ones that are coming from rumination of cows and sheep and goats. So it's in form of methane, enteric methane, as we call it, and also direct emissions coming from the manure of the animals. So all these emissions, if you turn them into CO2 equivalent, to make it easier to understand, are about 4% of all anthropogenic greenhouse gas emission, that means coming from human activities. And then we also look at indirect emissions. We know that there are greenhouse gas emitted through the production of feed and forages to give to those animals. And these are not directly emitted by the animals, but they can be allocated to what we eat in terms of beef and milk or eggs. If we add up all those direct and indirect emissions, it's about 14.5% of anthropogenic greenhouse gas emission.
When we look at meat consumption around the world, and how has it increased?
Well, it's been increasing quite fast, I would say, for at least 3 or 4 decades. The reason behind this is, of course, first, the global population, human population that is growing. So more people, more food, obviously, and more animal products. But also the fact that people become richer and richer in a way. The average income at global level is increasing. And we know that when you have more money, you consume more animal products, meat and dairy products in particular. And a third reason is also the fact that we live more and more in the cities. At the moment, we have about half of the human population living in the country and the other half in the cities. But more people in the cities means more access to restaurants, to refrigeration, also to electricity, to shops. And that means also more animal products. So the consumption of animal products has been increasing a lot in the past 20, 30 years. And it's still increasing, and we expect it to continue increasing in the next couple of decades.
In certain parts of the world, that would be a good thing in terms of people getting more nutrition?
Yes, certainly. Actually, at the moment, where the regions where meat consumption is increasing the most is developing countries. At the moment, we know that there are countries in the world where people eat about 4 kilograms of meat per person and per year. This is very low. But there are other places in the world where we exceed 100 kilograms of meat per person and per year. So there's a very large diversity of diets. But what concerns us here at FAO is the number of hungry people. We estimate that we have 821 million people still suffering from hunger at this stage, and that this number is increasing. So it's more and more people now that are suffering from hunger, and for these people, animal products can be a very good solution to improve the nutrition in an easy way, because animal products are very dense in terms of protein, of course, but also iron, zinc, calcium. So, for example, just a glass of milk per day for a kid can improve its nutrition very, very, very dramatically.
You mentioned indirect and direct causes or adding the emissions because of livestock. So I wanted to get more in depth about that, Anne. So when we're thinking about how we are raising livestock, whether it's in the U.S. or in other countries, if you could talk about the different processes, including how the feed is raised to feed them, how livestock are then grown and then processed and transported to places so people can eat them.
Yes, so the diversity of diets is very large, as we said, but there's an even larger diversity in the way we produce those animals. Think about it in already in terms of species. The livestock species are very diverse. You have cows, you have buffalo, camels, goats and sheep, and they are raised in pretty much every type of environment that you can find on planet Earth, from very extensive and dry areas like the Sahel in sub-Saharan Africa, to very high mountains in India, or at the other extreme, very humid and tropical places in Central America, or even more industrial types of farming like we can see in Northern America, for example. So all those types of production systems, like we call them, they rely on different types of feed and forages. We know that, for example, in feedlots in North America or in Australia, for example, animals like beef, they receive a lot of cereals, but also they can be fed with crop residues and byproducts from the oilseed industry, for example, soy cakes. In other places, those animals, they rely way more on grazing. So they spend most of their time on a pasture, just feeding from the grass or the leaves, with a very less rich diet, I would say. And both systems are responsible for emissions, but in different ways.
This is Where We Live. Joining us from Rome is Anne Motet, livestock expert at Food and Agriculture Organization at the UN, as we look at how the livestock industry around the globe is contributing to climate change with the greenhouse gas emissions. You know, so often, Anne, in this country, when we talk about global warming and climate change, we focus on carbon dioxide. But there's what you'd mentioned earlier about methane. And can you explain enteric fermentation for us and how again, these livestock are contributing to these emissions?
Yes, certainly. So enteric fermentation is the process through which the ruminants, so cows, sheep, goats, all types of animals that have different stomachs, can digest the forage, grass, leaves, straw, that we humans cannot eat because we don't have this capacity. But through this process, there is a byproduct, which is methane, that is released by the bacteria that those animals have in their stomachs. And this methane is exuded by the animals in the forms of burps, very, very simply. And this methane is then released into the atmosphere. So it's a natural process of digestion for those animals. But since we have multiply the number of animals very significantly recently, we have more and more animals, and therefore more and more methane being emitted. But there are ways to reduce that, and we can play on the quality of the forage to decrease the methane emitted from the digestion. But again, it's a natural process that will happen in any case with any ruminant.
When we think of rising temperatures, Anne, what is methane's impact when compared to carbon dioxide? Is it a larger impact?
It is a larger impact in two senses. First, it has a higher global warming potential than carbon dioxide. If you look at a time span of 100 years, carbon dioxide would have a global warming potential of 1 as an index, and then methane would be 34. So one molecule of methane in the atmosphere over 100 years has more global warming potential than carbon dioxide by a factor of 34. But another interesting thing is that you can reduce methane more rapidly because its half time in the atmosphere is shorter. So it disappears from the atmosphere more rapidly than CO2. So everything we do to reduce methane has a very strong impact on how we can reduce climate change.
We were talking earlier and asking our listeners if they think about how they should maybe change their diets to help decrease the impact of the emissions that we cause into the environment. And I'm curious, when we hear about how beef cattle produce so much methane, that the question then is, well, should we eat less beef? But then there's lots of farmers in the world who are raising other animals like chickens and pigs. And so what is their contribution when we think of climate change?
So it's true that because of enteric methane, ruminants contribute more to climate change than monogastric, like pigs or chicken. But they contribute in any case and in different ways. Monogastric don't release enteric methane, but they use a large amount of cereals and soya cakes from the production of soya that can also be responsible of emissions. For example, we know that in different places of South America, the production of soybean can be associated with deforestation, which is also a cause for climate change. So it's not an easy choice between. It's not really about switching from beef to chicken. It's a more complex, I would say, a system to consider and to look into the different types of production. But I think it's a very right thing to ask ourselves as consumers, what is it I'm eating? What is the contribution of my food to climate change or other environmental impacts? What kind of information is available to me? And what are my choices? We are lucky in Western Europe or in Northern America to be able to make those choices. And it's not the case for many people who suffer from malnutrition and hunger who cannot make those choices, not because they don't have the information, but simply because they don't have alternatives to their food. So I think it's a very right thing to do. But again, having in mind that you have to be informed to make those choices.
You were mentioning that it's not as simple as switching from beef to other meat because when we think about farming with raising pigs and poultry, we are also having to produce the food that they eat versus cattle that may graze.
Yes, exactly. That's the question. So if in the end we produce more cereals to feed more chicken to replace beef, then the solution is not entirely positive. And then what do we do with the million of hectares of grassland that and the pastures that cannot be cropped? We estimate at FAO that about 2/3 of the pastures and rangelands in the world cannot be cropped. So they just can be used to produce grass to feed ruminants. So we have to find the right balance and the right mix in production and in diets.
I mentioned, Anne, that you're with the Food and Agriculture Organization within the UN. And can you talk just briefly about some of the projects that you are working on to reduce carbon emissions from livestock worldwide?
Yes, we have quite a large number of projects for low-carbon livestock production, as we call it now. Recently, we have engaged with 13 countries in South America who have committed to invest in low-carbon livestock production. So it's, for example, we have a project in Ecuador looking at how to increase the productivity of cows in Ecuador and restore the quality of pastures, which is another way to actually limit climate change through storing more carbon from the atmosphere into the agricultural soil. So it's not only about reducing what the animals emit, but also storing the carbon into grasslands, for example. We have another project in Zambia and Malawi, just to give you another example, where we look at how to better integrate crops and livestock production by increasing the quality of the diet of the cows and returning the manure from the cows as fertilizers to the crop fields, and therefore making the whole system more efficient and reducing overall emissions.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Anne Motet joins us from Rome. She's a livestock expert at the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization. Now, coming up, we'll continue our conversation with her, and we'll be talking more about land use and learn about a different approach to cattle grazing that can help reduce emissions from livestock. You can join us, too. The number, 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Today we're talking about how livestock contributes to global warming, and we want to learn more about approaches to lessen their carbon footprint. You can join us too. The number 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Joining us from Rome is Anne Motet, livestock expert at the Food and Agricultural Organization at the UN. And I wanted to take a quick call. Ben is calling from Wallingford. Ben, go ahead with your question or comment.
Hi. I just want to say thank you for doing this show, because this is one of the main reasons I switched to a vegan diet 16 years ago. And I don't think it's that difficult, as people make out and as is done, for people in the developed nations to switch to a vegan diet that can be as healthy as anything that's based on animal production. And I think it's really imperative that a lot more people do that, given the damage that we've seen done from the hurricanes and the animal agriculture operations in South Carolina just this month.
Well, Ben, thank you for your comment. I wanted to ask Anne from the UN to address your question. And Ben was saying that he doesn't believe that it would be hard for people in developed countries to not switch over to being vegan. What's your take on that?
Well, I believe that's correct. Again, we're very lucky in high income countries, like we call them, to have the choice in many types of food. We can choose from high protein legumes, plant and we also even have supplements. If, for example, we're lacking some vitamin B12 from not having animal products in our diets anymore, we can find those supplements. So it is definitely possible. And some people even say that it's not even more expensive. So if it's a personal choice to do this, then by all means, if you feel comfortable and informed enough to do it, it's a very good choice to reduce your environmental impact.
I think about the income disparities here in this country, and while some people are able to switch over to veganism, it might be a stretch for some families to think about only buying specific food products and preparing food in certain ways. And in that sense, is that where government comes in with policies to help families if they wanted to make that switch to choose this healthier option?
Well, I think we're not really there yet. We know in the world that we have about 36 countries who have official dietary guidelines, basically the food pyramid, like we all know it, how much of each type of food items should you take every day. So it's really a limited number of countries that are looking into the nutrition already. I think the first step for governments would be to make sure that people are educated about food, children to start with in schools, that they have access to information, that they can taste different things, a diversity of food, not only a vegan diet, but they can choose from a large diversity of items and basically educate themselves on the tastes, but also where the products are coming from and so on. So I think before everything, the role of governments would be on education.
I wanted to bring into our discussion now Dr. Joe Orefice, owner and operator of Hidden Blossoms Farm in Union, Connecticut, because we wanted to get more perspective on efficiency and land use, and you also are someone who is raising cattle. Joe, welcome to our show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
You're also director of forest and agriculture operations at Yale School of Forestry. And so I wanted to get your take on when we think about New England, we think of dairy farms, not necessarily beef farms. Tell us why that is.
Well, dairy in New England was one of the last farming systems that kind of made it through the the hard times that we've seen with New England farming over the last 300 years. It's just been this constant change of what we grow here, primarily because of where we're competing with agricultural products from elsewhere. And for a long time, dairy was the thing that made it in New England because we couldn't ship milk long distances. And so those were the farms that held out when, you know, in the 1850s and 1830s, it was sheep farming. It was wool that dominated the landscape. And so we saw that change when we could start getting wool from other parts of the world. Dairy is essentially what lasted, but it's also a big part of our traditions now and sort of our landscape view because it's what we know.
When we think about the big ranches out west, grass resources are scarce. You're a proponent of grazing rather than feedlot cattle broadly. Can you explain your approach?
Yeah, well, you know, one of the reasons I'm an opponent of grazing systems is I always think about the inputs, and we're talking about carbon a lot today. And if we're inputting fossil fuels into our food, be it plants or plants being grown for livestock, That's a long-term carbon storage, like millions of years, that we're then putting into the atmosphere, as opposed to grazing systems and grasses where cattle can use their own energy, which is generated from those forages, to grow and to actually feed themselves. And so that's one of the reasons I've been promoting grazing systems. And then the other reason is to maintain soil integrity. So we want to have our soils staying where they are. We don't want them all ending up in the Mississippi River Delta, as we see where much of the heartland is ending up. And so having perennial crops keeps those soils in place. And, you know, on our farm, one of the things we make sure we do, and there's a lot of farms in the Northeast that have adopted this, and I sure didn't invent it, but rotational grazing systems, where we're actually moving the livestock in response to the plant's condition. And so that way, when our forages are at a certain level, we're moving the livestock before they're doing any damage, and then allowing those pastures to regrow and recover. So the carbon we're taking off is actually regrowing and being reallocated in plants in about 30 days, depending on moisture conditions, which is very different than rangeland systems out west, where you might need 100 acres to support a cow, for example. In Connecticut, you could support a cow on 2 acres.
The technique that you're talking about, it's called silvopasturing?
Well, that's one of the things okay. We practice. And so I'm really a fan of having a diversified pasture system. And so having your animals be able to access different conditions depending on their needs. So silvopasture is the integration of trees, forage, and livestock on the same unit of land. And it's an agroforestry practice, and it's definitely new to the region. But what it provides is some really beneficial animal welfare components in terms of always providing shelter from trees for livestock. The trees are actually being grown as a crop, so there's a secondary source of income there. And then the whole system is sequestering more carbon because the trees are more carbon than, let me make this clear, more carbon than an open pasture, a treeless pasture would. Because the trees are adding another place for that carbon to be stored on the landscape.
And so when we think about it, you're talking about rotation as well. You're not just letting animals loose in a forest. It's very intentional.
Yeah, for sure. You know, one of the challenges with the Northeast is, you know, one of our long traditions has been to just fence off the woods and put the cows in there or put the sheep in there. Or what some people are doing now is just like putting the pigs in there and pretending that they're eating acorns. And it's really a shame because that traditional practice, which sometimes we call just, you know, woodland grazing, is very destructive to soil. It's very destructive to tree roots, and it definitely is poor for water quality. Not to mention the animals often don't have anything to eat in there. And so that is really common. I mean, there's hundreds of thousands of acres of that in the Northeast U.S. alone. And there's no forage underneath, and so that's a problem because, one, it gets confused with silvopasture, which is a system that is actually rather robust and sustainable, but two, just from an environmental standpoint, has led to a lot of issues with our tree health and our our ecosystem functioning.
Anne Motte is with us from Rome. I just wanted to get her perspective on these techniques that Joe was talking about, Anne.
Well, I think he explained very well. I don't have much to add. He seems to be an expert in silvopastoralism and grazing systems in general. I was just thinking, listening to him, that there are even more benefits from the systems than just reducing greenhouse gas emissions or increasing the overall productivity, the overall biomass from 1 hectare. We also know that it's increasing the biodiversity that you find on those hectares, not only from having grass species and legume species and trees and the animals, but also because of a mosaic of a landscape in mosaic forms, usually hosts more insects and fauna than very specialized systems with homogeneous landscapes. So it's a good thing for biodiversity too. And I would even add it's a good thing to adapt to climate change because of the different depth of the roots from the trees and the grass, then you're using the water resources from the soil more efficiently, more of it, and also, well, the trees, they can provide some shade to the animals. So when you have a bit of drought or some days that are hotter than usual in summer because of climate change, then the animals can resist better by finding some shelter. So it's really interesting to see that those systems are also developing in the U.S.
I want to thank Anne Motte, livestock expert at the Food and Agriculture Organization at the U.N., joining us from Rome today. Anne, thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel. Dr. Joe Orefice will be staying with us. He's a Connecticut beef farmer, owner and operator of Hidden Blossoms Farm in Union, Connecticut, also director of the Forest and Agriculture Operations at Yale School of Forestry. We're going to talk more with him after the break. And the National Resource Defense Council. How should we think about the food choices we make if we're concerned about climate change? More on that after a short break. But first, it's WNPR's fall fundraising campaign. If you appreciate the different types of conversations we have here on Where We Live, now's the time to support Connecticut Public Radio. Here's the number to call. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel. Coming up Monday, whales are the largest living animals on the earth today, but did you know they used to be the size of dogs? On the next Where We Live, we'll talk with paleobiologist Nick Pyneson about his new book, Spine on Whales. It tells the story of his quest to understand the history of these creatures from the Antarctic to the desert and beyond. You can join us. That's on Monday. Now, today we've been talking about how the livestock industry contributes to climate change and approaches to help reduce greenhouse gas emissions from the sector. On the phone with us, before the break was Dr. Joe Orefice, Connecticut beef farmer and owner and operator of Hidden Blossoms Farm in Union, Connecticut. And joining the conversation now is Allison Johnson. She's sustainable food policy advocate with the Natural Resource Defense Council. Allison, welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you.
Earlier, we were talking about the work being done to improve efficiency, produce less greenhouse gases in the livestock industry. But when we think about, our individual choices and our listeners who might be thinking about this question, what should they be weighing in terms of the food choices they make?
Well, yes, beef is the biggest food source of greenhouse gases, so small changes in your diet can really have a huge collective impact. I think this is exciting news, actually, because it means you can fight climate change with your fork. For example, we've calculated that if Americans ate just 1/4 pound less beef each week, basically if everyone gave up one big burger a week in the U.S., it would be like taking 10 million cars off the road for a year. So that's a huge impact, and it adds up. Beef is 34 times more climate pollution intensive than legumes like beans and lentils. So each meal that centers plants and includes less or no red meat has an outsized beneficial impact on the planet.
We were hearing from Anne Motte from the UN earlier talking about this idea some may have of, well, just replace beef with poultry, but that also has a trade-off because then certain livestock that are non-ruminants are eating grain feed, and that takes up energy input in terms of fertilizer and land. And so I'm wondering what your organization's take is, because we know that poultry consumption has also grown.
Right. Well, there are two pieces there. So first, most beef in the U.S. is finished at feedlots where it is fed the same corn and soy that's fed to other livestock animals. So you don't eliminate that impact and the impact of all of the fossil fuel-based fertilizers and chemicals that go into corn and soy production. So beyond that, beef is about 5 times more climate pollution intensive than chicken or pork, and chicken is a little bit better than pork by our calculations. That has a lot to do with how long each of the animals lives. And as a side note, chicken is also way ahead of beef and pork in shifting to responsible use of antibiotics. Beef and pork account for about 80% of livestock sales of medically important antibiotics in the U.S. So all around, right now, chicken is looking like a more environmentally friendly option. But keep in mind, we go back to that stat that beef is about 34 times more climate intensive than legumes like beans and lentils. So if you're really looking for a big impact, swapping any meat for legumes or plants in some meals is a great place to focus your energy.
You can join our conversation here on Where We Live, the number 860-275-7266. Mary's calling from Hartford. Mary, go ahead.
I just wanted to also emphasize the significance of production in getting higher quality food. And I think a lot of people overlook the value of choosing organic or reading the labels to see if your milk is come from cattle that is grass-fed, or that your beef, you know, that you've selected, that you know the producer, that it's that your chickens are carefully, humanely managed, because very few people have really seen these mass feedlots up close, and the use of antibiotics, the caging of animals. I think people would recognize that they don't really want to ingest those foods, and there's really been significant improvements in the management, and it's all available in your grocery store if you read the labels.
Thank you, Mary, for that. Allison, did you want to respond?
Sure. You raise some really important points, Mary. If we're thinking about the impacts of beef specifically on climate, you know, the first solution is to eat less beef. But beyond that, it's often useful to zoom out and think about the overall impacts of different production models for beef. So feedlots generate an unbelievable amount of air and water pollution, as well as soil contamination, often with terrifying health impacts for the people and communities who live nearby. Feedlot cattle mainly eat corn and soy, as we've discussed. So those are grown with massive amounts of synthetic fertilizers and pesticides that are made from fossil fuels. And feedlots also rely much more heavily on antibiotics, a practice that contributes to our growing antibiotic resistance crisis. So you do have these great, well-managed grass-fed operations. Joe was describing some of those practices earlier that can sequester carbon in soil and generate much less overall pollution. So we really think of this as a less and better issue. Eat less beef and put those savings toward better quality grass-fed or organic beef when you choose to eat it.
I wanted to go back to Dr. Joe Orefice, who is a Connecticut beef farmer, owns and operates Hidden Blossoms Farm in Union, Connecticut. Joe, tell us about, do you feel like consumers are more open to buying your beef?
You know, I think some are. I think one of the challenges with our meat system is to buy beef from folks who are grazing and from folks who are able to raise it in the Northeast, where the cost of land ownership is just incredibly high. If they can pay for it, and Ann brought that up earlier, is it's almost a luxury to be able to eat environmentally sustainable because of the cost of raising animals in a sustainable way. And one of the challenges with that is that there's a little bit more labor in it, and fossil fuels are so cheap that we can produce food, be it food that we're feeding to livestock or just food for people, in row crop systems using tractors and everything else, and burning fossil fuel much cheaper than we can pay someone to do that labor that the fossil fuel is supplementing. And so I think, you know, there's a lot of interest in consumers doing it, and I think consumers are also finding that the flavor is a much better profile than you would find with I guess, more conventional types of food.
Well, we know that the federal government subsidizes big ag, but in terms of incentives for small farms, is that something that Connecticut helps with, Joe?
I haven't found a ton of resources in terms of incentives to help as a producer, but there are a lot of incentives for conservation. And so sometimes you can, you know, I grow vegetables as well, and my first high tunnel was paid for by the NRCS as a conservation mechanism. So we didn't have, because whenever you're growing crops like that, you have open bare soil when between tilling periods and the risk of erosion. So if you put plastic over the top, you can actually, you know, prevent some of that erosion. And so the NRCS paid for that. From my perspective, it was just a big boom. It actually paid for the next high tunnel in the following year. So there are ways of finding resources to help sort of subsidize the farm, but typically those are related to conservation mechanisms, and you can often get more money for those when you're causing a problem than when you're not causing a problem.
Earlier we heard you talk about how you rotate between regular pasture and silvopasturing. That can be better for the environment, but how scalable is it, and are you seeing more of this being done in our region?
Yeah, there's been a lot of interest over the last 10 years in silvopasture, and it's very scalable. The thing is, we have a number of technologies right now that make a huge difference, and they're simple. I mean, portable polywire, high tensile electric fencing around the perimeter. These things allow us to move animals really easily and really quickly. And the other thing is, a lot of it is just a change of the way farmers are practicing things, and in a way, for them to learn how to work with their animals, and their animals also to work how to know when to work with them. So when I'm going to move my cows, I just stand on the edge and I just call them down, and they all come and they sit, stand at the gate, and then I open the gate and they go through to the next pasture. Whereas the first time you do that, it sure isn't that easy. And so it's really about learning the new farming systems and learning which technology can work really well, even just tanks of water that you can easily move with a automatic float valve. So you don't have to water the animals out in the pasture every day. You just make sure you have water in essentially a hose going down to a tank with a float valve, and that saves you 2 hours a day and you know, loads with a tractor to move a tank of water. It's just, there's a lot of technology out there that's very simple that can do a lot for moving cows and grazing. There's even GPS collars now that will track how much forage your animals are taking in. So one of the challenges with pasture related to like real production ag has been that you don't know how much your animals are eating unless you're really trying to gauge how much the pasture is going down. But with these new technologies of collars, and I don't utilize these, but they're out there, you can actually, especially for dairy, you can monitor how much each cow is intaking over the course of a day. Kind of like a Fitbit for a cow.
Allison Johnson's also with a sustainable food policy advocate with the Natural Resource Defense Council. Allison, we were talking about individual choices earlier. What is the NRDC doing or seeing in terms of the restaurant industry? Because we know that people want more sustainable choices. How are they responding?
That's a great question. We eat a lot of meals away from home, and the three largest food service companies in the U.S. have immense power to shape the climate impacts of food served in tens of thousands of cafeterias and restaurants across the country. So the largest of these companies, Compass Group, has already made a public commitment to reduce its red meat purchases, and NRDC is working to convince the other two companies to make similar commitments. We're also surveying these companies' customers to find out how they're working to incorporate more plant-based foods into their menus. So there are a lot of important changes that individuals can make, but it's also critical to look to this broader food landscape and shift it to more plant-based work. We also survey fast food chains every year, and this work focuses on antibiotics. So this year we're shining the light on beef production, where the industry still has a really long way to go. But these huge buyers can invest in research, they can invest in farmers, and they have a lot of power to shape the climate impact of our food system.
Earlier, we were talking about, you know, income disparities in this country, and sometimes it can be hard to make certain food choices because of your budgets. And so I'm wondering, Allison, if you have tips for our listeners in terms of making sustainable choices that doesn't break the bank, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, one of the reasons that we focus on these large food companies is that they have the power to make sustainable choices mainstream. There's a lot of wiggle room as far as affordability when you're looking at large food purchasers. And then at home, using meat as more of a seasoning or a side dish than the center of the plate is a great way to keep that flavor if it's something you seek out while reducing your impact. And then the classic staple, rice and beans, is inexpensive, gives you full nutrition, and it's a great way to build climate-healthy practices into your daily menu.
I want to thank Allison Johnson again. She's a sustainable food policy advocate with the Natural Resource Defense Council. Allison, thank you for your time. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Also with us was Dr. Joe Orefice, who's a Connecticut beef farmer, owner and operator of Hidden Blossoms Farm in Union, Connecticut. Joe, before we end the show, what's your suggestions to listeners who want to do more to support local farms, and where can we see room for improvement?
Yeah, so I mean, the best thing, especially in the Northeast, that folks can do is buy from the farmer. So, you know, the food system, we lose a lot of value as it goes through the chain from, you know, distributor to grocery store to consumer. And so, if folks can buy directly from the farm, that's really the best option, because then that money can go to the farmer to help them support some of the sustainable practices, but also to learn about the practices that are going on the farm. Because just because it's a small farm doesn't make the practices necessarily sustainable. And so try to know your farmer and know what they're up to, and I think there's a lot of resources in Connecticut for that, where folks can, you know, there's farmers markets, there's some land trusts, there's the Connecticut Farmland Trust, there's a number of groups that are out there, there's the Connecticut Organic Farmers, there's the Farm Bureau. So there's a lot of resources in Connecticut where folks can find a farm in their town.
So we'll try to link to some of those at Where We Live. But we want to thank you, Joe, again for coming on, also director of the Forest and Agriculture Operations at Yale School of Forestry. Thanks, Joe. Today's show produced by Carmen Baskoff. Special thanks to Kion Wolf and our WNPR intern, Panina. And it's our fun drive, too. So please support us with a call now.